Thanks very much. I guess over the past couple of years, we've been working to develop models to try to deal with the effects of small-scale flows and small-scale fields in dynamo simulations. I think our primary interest has been in the geodynamo, so in a way, we're imposters in this session. But I think you'll see that the methods that we're describing are fairly general, and it may in fact be possible that these techniques that I'll describe today will be relevant for some of the other numerical simulations that we've either heard described or are planned for the astrophysical applications. This is just a picture of the vertical vorticity from one of Hiro Matsui's dynamo simulations that he did on the Earth simulator, and what the purpose of this is to show that the flows, at least that we're interested in, are strongly affected by rotation, but also develop very small scales by virtue of the fact that the viscosity of these fluids is very, very low. And this is a problem that is essentially common to all of the typical astrophysical and geophysical applications, is that numerical calculations can't resolve all of the scales in which arise in a particular problem. And since we're interested usually in the biggest scales, we have to deal somehow with the smallest scales. So the strategy that we've adopted, more of a philosophy, I guess, is that of the large eddy simulations, where you apply spatial filters to your fields so that you get them on scales that you can actually resolve on grids. Now, this will introduce some additional terms into your governing equations, and the LES formalism doesn't tell you how to evaluate those terms, but I think for us at least, what it provides is a rational framework for thinking about how to deal and approach this particular problem. So this is just sort of an example of how this approach works. If you haven't seen this before, we have the true field, which we convolve with some spatial filter, and this is just an example that sort of reduces the scales to ones that we can resolve, and I'll denote the grid spacing by this delta. So we just convolve a filter with the true fields, and this is what we can resolve on the computer, so that we want equations that can describe the evolution of these fields, which are on our we can resolve on the grid. So you would apply a filter to your temperature equation. This would be the equation that you'd like to evolve forward to keep track of the temperature that you can resolve. But the problem is that you can't evaluate either of these two terms in the form that they presently are. So the first, there's two steps that you would take to sort of cast this in a form which you need. First thing we do is we interchange the order in which we apply the derivative operators and filters, and then we have to sort of deal with these correlations which are missing from the explicit or resolve calculations. So this is just the first step. You interchange the order of the differentiation. So now we've got the filter operator being applied to the flux and then taking the divergence operator secondly. And same with the diffusion term. And so when you do this, you potentially have to introduce correction terms that account for the differences in making that operation. And if you were dealing with sort of constant grid size or constant filter size, these terms go away, but we'll see that for reasons, at least in our calculations, we'd like to keep this variable grid, and so we have to account for these. These are, relatively speaking, easy to deal with, but I'll sort of touch on them a little bit later. The second part is dealing with these missing correlations. So now what we've done is we've replaced the average of the product of these true fields with the product of their resolved quantities. And so we're missing this piece. We're missing this piece here. And so this difference then just becomes the subgrid scale, in this particular case, heat flux, that we need somehow to try to model. So at least provides us a framework for thinking about what these terms actually are and how we might go about trying to estimate them. Okay. Now the point is, in dynamo calculations, there are each of these nonlinear terms will give rise to one of these subgrid scale terms. So we've got subgrid scale heat fluxes, we've got the Reynolds stress or momentum flux, Maxwell stress and SGS induction terms. We want to sort of develop models for all of these terms and see how they work in our dynamo simulations. And so the strategy that we've adopted is one called the scale similarity model. And this is just sort of an example of how this particular technique works for the subgrid scale heat flow. So what we do is we take a test filter, which will be another filter which is coarser than the one that's implicit in our discretization of the problem. So here's our resolved fields, and we're going to apply some filter which we know something about to that field to describe this coarser field. And so schematically what we've got is this is sort of some amplitudes of your velocity spectrum. Here's sort of our cutoff and our grid, so these are the unresolved scales. corresponds to this part, which we're trying to calculate. And we apply a test filter to this, which gives us a slightly coarser grain solution, which is denoted by this part here. And so here's the true term. This is what we'd like to approximate. And what the scale similarity model does is approximate this term with this term right here. It involves essentially applying this test filter to our resolved fields. Now, to think about what this term means, it's best to think about what would happen if these tildes weren't here. So this would just be applying a coarse filter to the true solution, and it would essentially be, without this constant, it would be the true subgrid scale heat flux on a grid which was truncated right here. And instead of using all of these scales to calculate this term, what we're doing is just using this part of it. And that's essentially what this represents. And so the idea of self-similarity is that by calculating the effects of these scales on this scale, we maybe know something about what these scales are doing on those. And so similarity, in a sense, is exact. We're saying it's exactly the same, and the only thing that differs is essentially the amplitude of this coefficient, which we're going to have to try to figure out what that is. Okay. Well, one of the attractions, certainly one of the big attractions for us for approaching this technique was, one, that the approach extended to all the subgrid scale terms in the problem, which was nice. And the other thing was, it was a very natural way to sort of account for the anisotropy that developed in these fluxes. Because of the effects of strong rotation and because of the effects of magnetic field, all of these fluxes have strong anisotropies. And so as long as the resolved fields essentially reflect those anisotropies, then those will be expressed in these subgrid fluxes. And for our problem at least, this proved to be quite important. Okay, and so you can see that the generalization of the scale similarity to all these terms extends in a very straightforward way. Okay, just one comment, a note on how we implement this. What we do is, this is the scale similarity model. What we actually do is we expand these resolved fields in Taylor series and then carry out the application of the test filter explicitly, so that we end up, after some algebra, famous lines often, with sort of this nonlinear gradient model involving the product of the gradients and the velocity and the temperature. This gamma subscript 2 is the second order moment of the filter, the test filter that we've applied, and then here's this same coefficient. Turns out this model, which has come essentially by dealing with this, was in fact done previous by Leonard and Paper in 74. So this is the approach that we'll take with all of the subgrid scale models going from here to this sort of nonlinear gradient form. And so we have the task still of figuring out what that constant is. The commutation error is dealt kind of in the same way. Remember, it's the difference between applying the filter after taking the derivative or applying the derivative after taking the filtering. And so what we do is kind of the same thing. We expand this field, whatever it happens to be, that we're calculating this commutation error for. We expand these in Taylor series, do the filtering explicitly. And what you find is that this error can be expressed in this form. Now, we don't actually know what the second moment of our grid discretization is, and we don't actually know what this true fully resolved field is, but we think that the second moment ought to be proportional to the grid spacing squared, and we hope that we can approximate this function with the resolved function. And so what you'll see from this representation is that if the grid spacing, or the width of the filter essentially, which we're taking to be proportional to the grid spacing, was constant, this term would vanish. But in our problems where we have thin boundary layers, having the grid go finer toward the boundaries is important. And so we think that it's worthwhile trying to allow that to be the case and model this. And again, these proportionalities we hope to try to absorb into this constant, again, which we have to determine. So we have a number of sets of coefficients that we have to determine, one for each of the subgrid scale models, and another coefficient for all of the commutation errors that we're trying to include in this calculation. Okay, so the way in which we do the constant calculation is using something that's known as the Germano identity, and it's really quite a clever idea. It involves these three quantities. So this, specifically for the heat flux case, this was the true heat flux, the subgrid scale heat flux. This is what we would really love to know, ideally. But we can define other quantities which are sort of similar, related perhaps. Here's one which I've defined as the subgrid scale heat flux on a coarser grid, which we obtain by first applying the grid filter and then applying this test filter. Okay? We can also take this guy and just simply apply the test filter to both of those terms, and we get this thing. Now, with these expressions, we can't evaluate any of these guys because we don't know what these correlations are. We can't calculate those without knowing the true fields. But what you will notice is that this term here is identical to this. And so if we subtracted these two terms, we would get something which we can actually evaluate. And so the idea is that you take your subgrid scale model, in this case the nonlinear gradient model, and you substitute it for this term, and you substitute it here, and then you relate it to this thing which we can calculate. And hopefully the only thing that we don't know is that model coefficient for this particular term, which is common to both of these terms, and then we can use this expression to solve for it. So this is sort of dealing with that explicitly. So here's these two pieces that we're going to solve with our model, and there's the nonlinear gradient model stuck in there. Here's the piece that we can evaluate here. And so the only unknown is our model coefficient. We invert this in least squares sense to get this expression for the constant. And we do that for all of the subgrid scale terms. And so finally, our dynamic subgrid scale model would be this nonlinear gradient model with these coefficients determined from these expressions. Now, I should add that you could, in principle, calculate this constant for every grid point in your calculation. But it turns out you would get wildly erratic results. And you need to do some spatial averaging. And so in the results that I'm going to show, for plane layer models, we'll do averaging over horizontal surfaces as a function of distance from the boundaries. And for the commutation error correction, we'll just have one constant over the entire domain. OK, so the test case will be a plane layer dynamo model. And this is just a picture of the grid. It's periodic in the horizontal directions, and it uses Chebyshev collocation points for the grid in the vertical. And so you can see the actual grid points here, and also the grid spacings, giving you fine resolution in the boundaries and sort of more uniform spacing in the interior. And so you'd expect these were the regions where the grid is changing most, and so these would be the regions where our commutation error should basically stand out. And just to sort of give you a sense of the parameter regime that we're using for this particular calculation, shown there. So the idea here is to basically run a simulation with a relatively fine grid with the solution resolved. And so the results that I'll show you will just be initially just on a 64-cube grid. And with those parameters, we can get resolved solutions. This is just a picture, an isosurface of the magnetic field at one particular snapshot. And what we'll do is we'll take that fully resolved calculation, and we will filter it to a lower resolution, say 32-cube grid. And then we'll take the fields on this coarser grid, feed it into our subgrid scale models, and then compare the result that we get from that by actually explicitly calculating the true subgrid scale heat flux, or whatever it happens to be, from the fully resolved solution, and see how well they compare. This isn't actually a very great distance, but on the other hand, difference between these two grids. But on the other hand, if this doesn't work, it's probably not worth pursuing, is sort of the rationale. OK, so here's just sort of one example. It shows the divergence of the heat flux. This is our what I'll call the direct estimate. So this has been obtained from the formal definition of the subgrid scale heat flux using the fully resolved solution. So this is sort of the gold standard. Here's what you get for that. And I should say, this is actually at a surface which is kind of close to the midplane. So it's far away from the boundaries. The commutation errors should be smallish, at least in this region. And so here's what we get if we just simply take the constant for the nonlinear gradient model to be 1. 0 means we have no commutation error correction at all. And you might say, well, at least if you correlated that, you would get something which was positive, but maybe not great. If we add this commutation error correction with just unit magnitude, we get something which in pattern looks quite a bit similar, but the amplitudes are quite wrong. And when we actually determine both of these constants dynamically using the Germano scheme, we get something which actually looks remarkably like what we were trying to get. And so we took this to be quite encouraging. But this is really only just a snapshot, right? We've taken a set of fields and just done one comparison, no time stepping or evolution at all. This just shows how things are quite different near the boundary. Here we're very close to a boundary. Here's the gold standard again that we want to reproduce. If we just simply have the subgrid scale model, nonlinear gradient model, with no commutation error correction, you'll see that the pattern is quite different. Especially up in this region, you get a strong positive sign here, which simply doesn't appear in this calculation, for example. But you add the commutation error, you get essentially the spatial pattern looking pretty reasonable. A dynamic model, again, you're reproducing these fields pretty well. So we took this to be very encouraging. And so it was worth actually seeing whether or not we could actually make this work and be able to reproduce sort of finer scale solutions with essentially a much coarser grain calculation. So this just shows for a particular snapshot in the LES solution that I'm going to show you what the model coefficients actually look like for the different subgrid scale terms. So we've got the heat flux, momentum flux, magnetic stress, and induction terms. And you'll notice that they're all sort of order one, but not exactly one. They tend to have sort of nominally uniform values in sort of the convective interior, and the amplitudes tend to decay toward the boundaries. So this just comes out automatically or naturally out of the Germano identity, which is kind of nice because you would expect, of course, that these turbulent transport quantities should go to zero as we approach the boundaries, and they tend to do that. Okay. So the first, or the only test that I'll show using this technique was to look at some large-scale feature of these calculations. And one of the things that comes out of these plane layer models is that there's a horizontal component of the field which tends to sort of spin around like a pinwheel. And so that's what I've shown here, and we can sort of keep track of its phase angle in the horizontal, and then just sort of track what the orientation of that angle is as a function of time in one of these simulations. So what I'm showing you here is the results of a 96-cubed DNS in black, the results of a 24-cubed DNS, so this will be no subgrid scale modeling at all in the blue, and then the LES model with the dynamic subgrid scale nonlinear gradient model plus the commutation error corrections. And so what you can see is it doesn't take very long for just the unresolved DNS in terms of mapping this large-scale orientation of this field to drift off quite quickly. But in fact, the angle for the LES, this 24-cube grid, actually tracks that pretty well. So at least for this particular large-scale aspect of the calculation, the subgrid scale models are doing quite a bit of improvement to take us essentially from here with nothing to something which looks an awful lot more like the fully resolved calculation. So you think about what the relative number of grid points in these two calculations are. We're talking about a factor of 64. If you think that the coarser grid spacing permits you to take larger time steps, we're getting probably about a factor of 100 improvement in the calculation. Now, from our point of view, the interest here is not to get more efficient dynamo calculations, but rather to try to get dynamo calculations which have more realistic physical parameters going into them. So the idea is use parameters which don't permit resolved calculations and hopefully support the solution by using these subgrid scale models and just see how close we can get to the realistic situation. So for our applications, we're interested in spherical geometries, but again, these techniques apply relatively easily. There are other geometries. There are some complications that arise when you deal with sort of filtering these geometries. There's issues that you have to think about in terms of how you do the averaging to get sort of consistent results. But this is sort of where we're headed, and Hiro has a poster at the back that sort of discusses some of the preliminary results that we've gotten so far with this spherical geometry, specifically for the geodynamo problem. Maybe I'll... And leave lots of time for questions, hopefully, if there are some.
Questions.
Yeah, you say that your model is able to capture anisotropy, but you seem to use the same constant in all directions, so I'm sort of puzzled.
Yes, that's right. But I guess what's important to realize is, yes, you're absolutely right. But here's the catch, is that this is a scalar, but this term here, this root term, is the anisotropic part. So, for example, let's think of the heat flux. It's easier because it's just the vector. So the 1, 2, and 3 components will all be different and very anisotropic because essentially the anisotropy is captured in the velocity field and temperature structure. And so because of that, the anisotropy arises from this part here, essentially. And then we're just trying to scale this to allow for the fact that we're not actually, we're using a different set of scales to try to quantify this effect. So I think that's the key point. And I can say in sort of small periodic box calculations where you can, you know, do these calculations with very, very low viscosities where the anisotropies are very, very strong, what you find is that these do quite a remarkable job in capturing the relative amplitudes of the anisotropy. The trick in pushing these to very low viscosities is getting this coefficient about right.
Bruce, would you comment on whether or not this method could work if the high wave number parts of the spectrum that you're modeling are not monotonic or smooth or
yeah,
parallel?
So it absolutely depends on there being something kind of analogous to an inertial range where you can say that the physics that's going on at the scales, we sort of imagine that model that what's going on at this scale is actually the same physics that's going on at the next. If that divide was, say, some threshold between going from an inertial range to a viscous regime, it wouldn't work very well. And you can see examples, we've seen examples, where it fails catastrophically when you do that. So, yeah, the answer is yes.
Just a stupid question. What do you mean by dynamic coefficients? Is it dynamic in time or?
So I mean they're dynamic both in space and time.
Okay.
So they evolve. I would say, though, that what we found, at least in the plane layer model, is that if you evaluate these coefficients every time step, you find that they don't change very much as long as you have sufficient spatial averaging. And so currently in the plane layer models, we average over horizontal surfaces. So what we're currently doing is we tend to update these coefficients, say, every 10 time steps or something like that. But the point is that they vary with space and they vary with time. Yeah.
And second question is, you say that the existence of the inertial range is important, but if you have an inertial range, then your expansions in terms of gradients for like any
right.
kind of field
well,
is probably
yeah,
not
inertial
correct,
range
right?
was probably a bad choice of words because in these calculations, the inertia plays a relatively unimportant role. In fact, the most important terms of these, I should say in terms of the dynamo modeling, geodynamo modeling, what we tend to do is use a turbulent diffusivity for this term and turbulent viscosity for this term. And what we found in these calculations, at least at the parameter regimes that we're working is, it's actually the magnetic stress and the induction terms which play the biggest role in the energetics of these small scale flows. And currently in the dynamo models, geodynamo models, we don't have any terms for these. Now, whether that stays true as we get to better resolutions and get closer to realistic calculations, I don't know. But so all I really meant was that there is sort of a self-similar structure to the physics. So the physics that's happening at these scales is the same as the ones that are below the truncation that we're trying to model. If it turned out, let's say, that we had some, if we were injecting energy, for example, into the flows right at this boundary between where we were resolved and not, there was no chance that this extrapolation is going to work.
Yeah, but my point was that in the expansion you're making, like putting these gradient products in there,
yes.
would be more valid if you had a smooth velocity field, which means no inertial range.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. That could be true. Yeah, that could be true. You know, it was also the case that it seems like the commutation error should also be a problem, that, you know, the small scales could potentially dominate those gradients. And so that was a concern, and yet still the results seem to be pretty encouraging. So it doesn't seem to be, a showstopper.
So I don't know if this question makes sense, but you know, can you go to the commutation error correction?
Yeah.
It seems like you're making the self-similar assumption on the second derivative.
Yes, we are.
And that somehow seems inconsistent with the self-similar assumption that you made in the field variable.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, so it was inspired by that approach, but it's conceptually different. That's right. And so. And this is what I guess my comment was, that it wasn't obvious really that this would be a good approximation for that. And yet, it seems to, when we actually do the comparison in the boundary layers where the commutation error is biggest, it does a surprisingly good job in doing it. So the hope was not, I wouldn't describe it as proof, but our hope was that somehow we could absorb the differences with this coefficient. So we do a Germano identity, we apply that Germano identity to this as well. We determine these coefficients dynamically. So these coefficients can, in fact, evolve with time.
We'll have the last questions, Kim.
I'm interested in the case of hydrodynamic turbulence in homogeneous isotropic. Over the last few years, it has become evident that there is a large bottleneck effect
yes.
in forced turbulence
yes.
simulations,
yes.
and there's also a significant correction stronger than the Scheele-Weck correction of 0.1
yeah.
K times to the minus 0.1. Is that being reproduced with
modern
applications
of the
Germano model?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so when these techniques were applied, these techniques have never been used by themselves. What often happens in standard homogeneous turbulence is that this scale similarity has some eddy viscosity that's attached with it because the model doesn't dissipate enough energy. But I think for our calculations, what we're finding is that it's not the Reynolds stress that's playing the important role. Our systems tend to be very dissipative. And so the inertia in these flows is very, very low. And I think the reason why it's working is simply that effect, that we're not, our problem in some ways is not as complicated as the homogeneous turbulence flow because inertia just doesn't play as big a role. They're very dissipative. In fact, if you turned off gravity to a first approximation, the flow should stop.
How about using huge resolution? Make the problem better?
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. So for our purposes, again, what we were trying to do was something better than we have currently done in the dynamo to add these additional terms, which at least in the scale range that we're looking at seem to be more important, and see how far we can go with it. I would be very surprised if we can go all the way, but, you know, again, if it allows us to sort of get more realistic models, this is kind of our goal.
Okay, let us thank Bruce again.